Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking compaction. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at Dairy World Dairy Expo. Egg History Minute, we'll also be talking the history of World Dairy Expo. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. To go back and listen, the way I said agronomy, it almost sounded like I was about to cry.
Don't cry, Matt.
Not about to cry.
Is it making you feel like you're going to cry?
I just love it so much.
That was a good cry.
No, I don't know. It was just how it sounded in my head. It was like
some sort of
the weather's
deep
nice
emotions coming out.
Shouldn't cry, Matt.
No, it's been pretty decent. We're in the 80s again, which is kind of ridiculous.
Record highs.
But yeah, I guess maybe we got fall and it was those couple weeks at the end of August and beginning of September and that was it. But we'll see.
I had a grower tell me yesterday that October is now September. Everything's just shifted.
Just shifted back a month.
Like we're getting April and May.
Yeah.
September and
spring's shifted
October.
A bit. And
yeah, I think we've talked about this before. I worked with a guy back in college when I worked at the power plant in Green Bay that had the same theory back then. This was 20 years ago. It was, everything.
Way
the seasons are just
global
shifting.
Warming.
Like, we're just going to see the seasons shift where, you know, like you said, October will become September. And so, it doesn't seem to work out that way every year, though. Like, some years we get cold September. Been a couple, but I think in the last five we've had at least one or two cooler, where it was like 60s, 70s.
Good for wheat and cover crops growth.
Yeah.
Yeah, wheat's storming out of the ground in general. It's looking good.
Yeah, there's a farm I work with that planted some bio strips, and those are like huge.
Like how big?
It was after wheat, but the brassicas are probably 14 inches to 16 inches tall. And the clover, all the clovers I've seen so far planted like after wheat are at least, 6 inches tall.
That's a new term that I've...
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Bio strip. Yeah, so the idea is they planted clover, oats, and some other stuff. They split the drill, essentially. And then where they're going to plant...
What was the drill? Yeah.
Where they're going to plant corn next year is a cover crop that's going to die. So then you'll have your living cover crop. It's kind of like strip till without a strip till bar.
Sure.
How do they... How in the plant, like, do you have to put some sort of dividers, obviously, and then dump the seed?
Yeah, they basically split up the...
So there's no rows shut off either.
This is just a manual
cover crop that's going to die, and then...
Yep, and then you just plant into the...
So 7.5-inch row on a drill?
Yeah, give or take, yeah.
Yeah, and then so two rows where the living...
So
through winter and spring, cover crop. And
so it's like strip. And then next spring, it's going to be strip planted, like corn, strip of corn, strip of beans, that way?
Nope. They'll plant into the dead strips. So it's strips now. So you have a brassica that's going to die.
Got it.
And then you in the other strips, you have cover crops that will overwinter.
Got it.
So you will have a living cover crop
in
strips, and then you'll plant into the
bare. Todd, you're like nodding like,
I've heard of it before. This is a cooler concept.
Yeah, it's
North
cool.
Dakota is a place I know they've
North
done
Dakota,
it.
North Dakota, yeah.
Because at the WASH conference a couple of years ago, they had a group from North Dakota that came in, and there was one guy that talked about doing this.
So you're not splitting up like whole sections of your drill. You're splitting up the whole drill, small sections in the whole drill.
Correct. Wow. In order to plant specific species in specific spots. The drill to planter ratio isn't going to be exact, so it might be off a little bit in some spots, but...
Oh, sure, to line everything up properly.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless you had in this case, the farm doesn't have a drill the same size as the planter, so it's not going to... The planter's bigger. So.
Right.
So there might be a little bit of off there, but I mean...
You couldn't do that with an air drill.
No. Not a central fill area.
Are the dividers a pain in the butt? Like to get.
Didn't seem like it was that bad. Good. I mean, he did all their wheat fields that way, so it wasn't like he was constantly having to switch it back and forth. He just did it, put it in, and took it out when he was done. Yeah. So. I didn't ask what he used for dividers. I'm assuming he just took a piece of
cardboard
or something and cut it to shape. Because I know I've always heard the fridge magnet trick
for covering. That's my favorite trick.
But I don't think that would work in this case.
Last year's Packer schedule, fridge magnet, and then
cover holes.
Put it to cover
right,
holes.
Right, so to plant 15-inch rows with a 7.5-inch drill. Yeah.
Or whatever. Or realtor sends you the magnet or whatever. Now, though, it does seem like these fridge magnets are more. Like the top is the magnet, and then the bottom is just like paper.
Yeah,
this has to be like that full on.
Yep.
You know, magnet.
It's like when you go to the first Brewer game of the year,
and right? And they hand
magnetic schedule. Yep.
That's fun.
Well, at least there's positive news in the Brewer world. They were
clinched a division,
the Central Division,
3 years in a row.
Really?
Yep.
I wouldn't have guessed that, and I should know that. Yeah,
three years in a row.
That is awesome.
Yep. Mr. Greg moved on to Chicago, and he can't do it, and Brewers keep doing.
The Pat Murphy is, like, the coolest guy ever. So for people who don't like the Brewers or aren't a fan, but he's the manager. You got to listen to even clips of his Bob Costas interview.
Oh, I saw some
the weekend. It's just great. Like, he's just.
Did he have a pancake in his pocket?
Yeah, he's just, like, a regular guy. But he knows how to get people motivated, excited, manage. Like, he just, you wonder, like, he obviously coached under Craig Counsell.
Yep.
And so you wonder how much of Craig Counsell's magic was due to Pat Murphy and keeping that locker room.
Probably a lot.
Together and happy. You know, is Craig Counsell going to be a good coach? We know that, but he hasn't had much success so far. And so, yeah, Pat Murphy just seems like really cool guy. I heard at the coming Brewer games, if they're going to give out like pocket pancakes and stuff, like so he's got all these weird things that he's just, quesadillas in his pocket.
Did you see those interviews with the gal from Apple that he did those with?
No.
You got to find those too, because obviously he pulled out the pancake first and she chuckled about it. And then they had another Apple TV game like a couple weeks later. And, of course, she's like, now what is he going to do?
Right.
And he pulls out a quesadilla out of his pocket. And the look on her face is just priceless. She's like, what next? You know, like, what are you going to come up with next? But he just played it off and didn't even, like, bat an eye. And she had syrup ready to put on the pancake.
Nice. Did he dip the quesadilla in syrup?
And then she dumped the syrup on the quesadilla. The great part is she actually worked in Green Bay at a TV station. Okay. So she has... She's from Indiana, because I heard an interview with her. She's from, or went to college in Indiana. Maybe she's not from Indiana, but, and I feel bad. I don't remember her name. But anyhow, she has Wisconsin ties, so she bought some Wisconsin maple syrup she had in her pocket.
Trisha Whitaker.
Yes. So that's, it was neat interview. Like, she played it off great, and he played on her really great as far as just joking around with it, and. It's a fun deal.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Packers couldn't seal the deal in Cleveland, but...
I feel like they thought they'd just put their helmets on and win.
Yeah, that was a good tune-up game for them to realize that it's not going to be super easy. Which, I mean, to Cleveland's defense's credit, they were doing a
very
good job.
Cleveland's defense is very good. Yeah. They are very good.
I saw a clip yesterday. Miles Garrett must have just, like, whoever he was trying to block him, he just, like, whoop, right by. And then he yelled, run, Jordan, run.
Oh, yeah, the offensive lineman turned around,
Yeah.
And yelled, just
run, Jordan, run.
Run, Jordan, run. It feels like something, like, at the pro level, that is wild.
Right.
Like,
that's just like a seventh.
Feels
grade
like
thing.
Right. Coaching flag football, and you turn around and say, "Yeah, not at that age where."
yeah, he had to run a lot and didn't always get away. But
they weren't by any means playing a good game, but it did feel like the last 3 minutes, it felt like those games were.
What I don't understand is why was Zach Tom in at the very beginning?
Right, because they said he wasn't really ready.
Right.
So
that seemed like a bad move. He's getting sacked a lot or hit a lot. Then, yeah, they get the last 3 minutes, throws a pick. They manage to get the ball back. Special teams flubs the field goal as on par with our special teams.
Not special.
And then, yeah, the one time, which, I mean, they had to be gassed from how much they played, but the defense couldn't stop Cleveland then from getting into field goal range.
They didn't need to go very far
either,
so that was a tricky.
No, but, I mean, there were opportunities to stop them
right.
on a couple penalties, which that was the other issue is, I don't know how many penalties
it was a both lot.
Teams, but it was a lot.
It was a lot.
The Packers had like 13 or 14.
Enough watching them, some of them were like, really? Like, that was pretty.
A lot of offsides, false starts.
Yeah, those were real, obviously, but some of the pass interference stuff. You went, okay.
We were driving home from something, and we had the radio on in the car, and it was like the 6 minute mark, and Larry made some comment like, the 6 minutes is going to feel like forever.
Yeah,
and I was like, yeah, this is bad. Like, they're on a track to just flub this up.
Yeah, I don't know.
On to Dallas.
Yep.
On to Dallas.
On to Dallas.
Green Bay South.
Let's keep it that way, yes.
All right. You guys ready to talk compaction today?
Yeah.
So, Bill, you said you were seeing some interesting things in the field that made you think of this topic. So, what do you got for us?
Yeah, I was. Corn silage is pretty much now in full throttle, I would think, on most farms, if not all farms. Some are probably done. Some are almost done. I know there's a few that haven't started with some later maturity corn that's just hanging on. But I was riding in the dump cart on Monday, and it just had rained a little bit, just enough to make it smeary. So they had the dump carts out, which is fine. It's great. But the more I rode in the dump cart, the more, I don't know, mad is the right word, but just the more puzzled I got about just watching the operation of what's going on. And I'm not trying to target this one crew, but I'm sure it happens everywhere. And just talking about like the logistics of doing it right to minimize compaction. They had a couple dump carts going, not a lot, because they weren't far away from the farm, so they didn't need a lot of motion. They didn't need a lot of stuff going, but it was hard because, like, the dump carts were driving all over the place. And then what really kind of upset me was the way the semi-drivers, like, I've seen them sometimes where they'll just stay on the road and then, you know, the dump carts will drive on the road and dump, which is probably the best way to do it. I'm sure it's not the fastest way to do it, you know, because you got to get on the road with the dump cart and then get back.
Right.
But, like, the semis, there was four or five semis rolling, and they weren't, like, they were coming in the field at the same spot, but they were just parking everywhere. Like, some would park right up against the road ditch. Some were parking up against, like, the corn rows, like, on the inside of the field. And then one was parking in the long rows between where they had opened up the field. And it's like, all of a sudden now we got all these different areas where we're staging trucks. And it was like, we got to have a little better organization on how we're doing this. Cause I'm really fretting what this field is going to look like next spring now.
So it's the opposite of controlled traffic. It was uncontrolled.
Yeah.
Traffic.
It was uncontrolled. And then yesterday I was coming into work and a guy was chopping and I was surprised that the semis weren't getting stuck. Like it was like they were sinking in a good 4 or 6 inches and they didn't have dump carts and whatever. It's quicker to go right into the truck. I get it. But so just trying to have a discussion about, I assume every farm talks about this, but I feel like after these two encounters, they don't.
I think it gets to be in season. You want to get done.
It's go time. Yeah.
It's just go time. And it's, you find drivers from wherever you can, you especially contrasting like grain harvest versus silage. Like silage, you have four times the amount of people and drivers versus grain is usually right. just the same grain cart guy. And so it's less of a, you know, both things you still got to make sure you manage, but on silage harvest, it's a lot more people. And it almost, I think to the drivers feels like if I'm not beelining straight for that chopper, or if I'm, you know, kind of taking my time, the other guys are going to get on the radio and give me crap, or, you know, like
the chopper guy's like, where the hell are you?
Right. So it's almost like a culture that you've got to create that it is okay to slow down a little bit and do this the right way.
And I have
rather than just go and go, Matt, you've been on harvest crews with chopping. And what would you have to specifically say to
besides the, not wanting to go to one chopper guy?
Right. Right. Yes, there's always that. But no, it is, you know, a lot of times you're at a farm, but you're already thinking about the next farm because it's like you said, it's go time. So you're just trying to get the loads in and out. And yeah, when I was doing it, I wouldn't say there was any sort of plan laid out. It wasn't like, you know, within reason. There were some guys, there was one farm in particular, I remember, because it was a little wetter and it was hay, that, you know, they were more strict on, okay, you know, don't dry it. Like, if you're not getting filled, either stay in the headlands, or, you know, if you're the next one to get filled, make sure you're right behind the other one, like following the same track. Don't, you know, don't ride alongside or, you know, offset to make sure. But, you know, unless it was that situation where you're going to wreck a hayfield, I don't remember much discussion of like, oh, yeah, no, when we're in the silage, you know, just to do that same kind of thing, you know, single file lines. And
whose job do you think it is to you? I thought that was unique. Is it the custom harvester? You know, the guy who owns the custom harvesting company, the guy who runs the custom harvest, or is it the farmer's job to do that? Like,
well, I think the farm's got to communicate to the custom harvester, like, hey, I don't want you to do this. I think
it is interesting. For some reason in my head, it's somewhat both, but it probably actually falls on the farmer more, because the custom harvester guys, they think also the farmer, their best interest is like, we just got to get this harvested as quickly as
well. And that was the other thing, as I'm riding in the dump cart, the guy is going through, like, we're talking about what it costs. And he's like, yeah, that guy's whatever an hour and this chopper is $600. Like, so there is some of that too, Todd, where like, get this field off as fast as we can, because every hour is $1,000 or 12, whatever that number is. The people listening know that probably by heart, but.
Well, I think there is responsibility on the custom harvester too, but if the, just knowing how some of that communication goes sometimes, if you're not saying something, they're not going to assume anything. They're just going to be like, oh, he wants the field off. You know, there's discussion of pile and packing. Like we had that discussion with Bill Eberle a few weeks ago on, you know, whatever the right pile is. I think there's more communication on that end sometimes than there is on the harvest end. It's like, oh, it's ready, let's go. We got to get this on the pile and covered. Rain's coming, whatever. There's so many different factors that go into this that, you know, it's easy to forget to have that conversation. But if you don't have that conversation, I don't think you can just assume somebody's going to do it for you.
I think you're right, and I think we're always taught you're going to go from point A to point B in the quickest way. So what's probably the biggest pet peeve is a trucker, you know, or truckers usually don't, because it's too rough, so they can't bomb across.
No, I will say no, Todd. I was just, not the two farms I just talked about, a completely different one. I was in a pretty big field on Tuesday, soil sampling, and there's this random semi-beeline, like, angled.
Okay, it was.
He angled just, through the field, like, not even, it was like, a, you know, kitty cornered all the rows, like angled through the whole field. Like, where did this come from? Like,
and the example I gave of the hay field that I was talking about, I remember distinctly, the farmer was in one of the trucks or the tractors. Okay. Like,
yep.
So he was on the radio, reminding everybody, and like he was on everybody.
Yeah.
And that's why I say, I think, you know, if you don't have that conversation, if it's not the farmer putting that forward,
right.
Not always, you know, some custom guys, maybe that's how they roll. They,
right.
They tell their crew, if they have a regular crew, which can be hard, like we said, you know.
Right. I agree. That's a good point. This probably is an irregular guy.
Well, and think about today, like, you have a custom harvester crew, right? And you know the name of that crew. You know who it is. But then all of a sudden, like, I've noticed with one of your farms, Todd, all of a sudden, like, the neighbors are there helping.
Yeah, there's other truckers.
It's like, all of a sudden, they're done, and they probably need help trucking.
Right.
So all of a sudden, these new crew members are in because they need some work or whatever, and it's like, there's some distinct.
Yeah.
It's like summer help. Some are help, some are not. And so you got to make sure that you're getting the right people in the right places. Like, maybe that's the guy to be on the pile if he's the one that's going to drive diagonally across the field. You know what I mean?
I just couldn't believe that on Tuesday. I'm like, there's this random diagonal semi-track. Like, it couldn't have been very comfortable for the driver.
No.
Right.
I've been there. I've had times where I've had to go across the rows, and it's not ideal.
Fun at all, right. Was he full or empty?
I don't know, because this was after harvest, right? It was, I was soil sampling, so the field was gone.
Well, you just saw the track.
I just saw the one random.
Got it.
Random, like.
Right, the random tracks, yeah. No, because that's the other part with controlling traffic is it's way more important when you're full of feed.
Yeah.
Of trying to exit properly because you're that much heavier. Both are important. But, and let's be real with what probably is that the first wheel track does the most damage.
Right. Yep.
The subsequent wheel tracks over those wheel tracks don't hurt anything. You know, or this is a bad way to say it. They do make it worse, but the damage has already been done.
The majority of the damage is done the first time.
So we always think too, like, you don't want to make lanes or any of that, but you do. You do want to drive over the same area as much as you possibly can.
It's just about percentage, right?
You're
reducing.
But so what this guy might say, well, it's less percentage because I just beelined across. So the square root of those is less percentage. However, you're going over every row and every, yeah. Like, whereas if you take headlands, those are our traffic areas,
yep.
Headlands, and then cut, you know, with the chopper. With the other one that seemingly gets me lately is the amount of trucks following the chopper at times.
Yeah,
you know, like
three in a row,
right?
Just like, circling
right.
the field.
Like,
basically.
I could see having, you know, one and maybe a second one in case you know that one's getting full. But I've seen it where there's like a third truck just for fun following. And I get it, you need a truck right there when the chopper's done. But there again, I think is a spot for communication from probably more so from the chopper guy, probably. But Matt, what would you say being on the chopper crew? How did you know that, like, okay, I got to just stage on the side of the field here and wait?
Yeah, you'd try to watch. A lot of the wagons and stuff weren't covered, so you could kind of see. If you could see the chopper, you could see where things were. And other times you might be on the radio and be like, hey, you know, like, if when you change fields, especially, like, that's a whole nother game.
Yeah, because there's so much silage out there,
right.
And it's a mess.
But when you could see it, usually you would wait at one end of the field or the other for the chopper. And after a while, you knew how many trucks there were, how many guys there were. Like, so there's the guy that came right after you who's being filled. And depending on how many tractors and choppers are running, there's probably was a guy behind him or that's watching to take over that spot. So then you'd have to try to figure out which end of the field to go on.
Which I would think would be hard.
Right.
Like,
so then you go in the driveway and you pick an end, like, you knowing which direction you went, and depending how far you're making the run too, and usually you had more guys the further the run was, but you know, you might be gone for 10, 15 minutes.
Right.
So you're trying to do mental math of where the chopper ended up.
Almost every time you come back to the field, you come back to a new field.
Right.
Especially in corn silage, you come back to more is gone. Where do I go? Where are they? Did they split the field yet? All those kinds of things.
Yep.
I did have two farms that they changed the orientation of planting based on to
on driveways
on for harvest.
Okay.
Like, and it's not like we changed it completely to make the row shorter, only because if we oriented it the long way, which would have been better for planting and spraying and all those things to get longer runs, like if the long the field driveway ran parallel to the field the long way, they'd have to go all the way to the end of the field and then go around the corn and then hit the driveway. Whereas if we oriented the field perpendicular, then they could just sneak out and hit the driveway wherever. They wouldn't have to go all the way to the end of the field and then hit the driveway all the way back.
Sure.
So I think some of that too is like, think about the orientation of your fields, and you may want to switch them just to help with harvest and get that semi or whatever off the field onto the headlands as quick as possible.
And I don't know what you guys have heard for yields, but just knowing what I've heard from some people for yields is then you get that component too of last year, maybe it took two trucks or two
right.
loads to get across the field. This year might be three. So right. then that math is different even more because they're not getting as far before filling up a truck.
It's a third more wheel tracks then.
Right.
I think the other thing we got to watch, and none of us are tire experts in this podcast, but I think one thing you do have to watch is tire pressure and make sure that's correct. You know, and anything, whether it's your planter tractor, your sprayer, or anything, make sure that you watch those kinds of things as well. The kind of tire you use as well as the pressure. And I'm sure most guys are dialed into that, but it's one thing to watch.
Yeah. And I think the short memory thing of, you know, we got to get the job done. We got to get it done now. We'll worry about the consequences later. Then you kind of forget about it over winter until you go out to that field or, you know, depending on when you do your tillage and everything. Like, this is a problem that's in the back of the mind to begin with sometimes, and then it goes out of your mind until you reap the benefits, air quotes there, of what happened in the field. Like, next year, next spring, whenever they're back in that field trying to do something, they're going to see probably some of those wheel tracks come through if they don't treat the field properly. So
we always say that in soybean cyst nematode is like the hidden yield robber.
Yep. Yep.
And I think compaction is a very hidden yield robber. And in a lot of ways too, like we go try to say use our penetrometer and map out where there's compaction. Well, wheel tracks, you can't exactly harvest wheel tracks don't. Plow layer, you can map, but wheel tracks, you might hit one, you might miss one. It's a little different. You can't necessarily map it.
If you want the best idea, is as soon as the harvest is done, if you have a drone, find somebody with a drone, fly over the field, and look at the tracks. You'll, I did a video with our soil mapper one time, and the first thing, and I hadn't really even paid that much attention to it, but I had somebody come up because I had done a wheat field, and the video, part of it was in the wheat field, and the guy goes, "What the hell happened in that field?" I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, look at those tracks." And there was a spot that you could see from the drone where, you know, there were crisscrossing tracks in the middle. Like, it was a super highway. Like, there were trails going everywhere. And it's like, yeah, why were they doing that? Like, that's terrible compaction. Like, not only is it the worst in the middle where everything intersected, but then you've got all these offshoots. Like, you're not going to be able to fix just one section. You got to go through and you got to fix that whole thing because of the way they drove.
And I think you guys just brought up a really good point of more yield means more compaction. There's physically more tons that are traveling over that soil. Like, you're going to have more compaction just because of that if you don't control it properly. And so 100%, I like your idea of a drone, Matt, because I think you would see, you'd be able to overlay that with the next year and go, okay, this is why these spots sucked.
Or even like if you're the combine guy and you can mark a pin, like you're going through the field and it's not a wet spot or, you know, somewhere you know that never yields good because of whatever reason, like you're driving along and there's just, why is this spot not yielding well? mark a pin and then go back afterwards and get your, you don't need a pentrometer, you just need a rod. Check the compaction, dig some roots, see what it looks like. I mean,
will digging roots though get you that, Bill? Because those are just the roots. You're saying the following year dig the roots.
Oh, I think even in the fall.
You but can, like, would you, those roots were like there. They're not going to show compaction from that particular
fall. No, they're not. But they're going to be like, it's a postmortem of what we did during the year. It's right. not going to be a harvest. No, yeah, you're right. Right, Todd. It's not a harvest predictor of compaction. I'm saying like, I just know there's a couple soybeans fields I have that look bad. And when we dug roots this summer, it was a 3-inch tillage compaction layer.
Yeah.
And the roots went down and they J'd to the side.
Beautiful J turn.
Yep. Almost an L. Some of them were a complete 90. But just, there's certain areas at harvest that you could pin to be like, what happened here? And we always say our yield average goes up if we bring the bottom up. But it's hard to bring the top up, but can we bring the bottom up?
Like, to your point too, Todd, about, you know, the hidden aspect of it. The ruts and where, you know, they're digging in four, five inches, those are the obvious places.
Right, we know those.
It's the other spots that you can't see that, you know, maybe they were thinking about no-tilling the field, and if they put a cover crop in, you could dig cover crop roots.
Yep.
Potentially this fall or next spring, and then you might be like, oh, I should do something.
Right, we have a problem.
In these spots, because look at these roots. My, you know, corn roots, soybean roots, whatever's going in there next, probably is going to do the same thing. All right. Well, there you go. There's some things to think about as you're finishing out, or maybe you're just beginning harvest this season, but things when driving across the field, think about that compaction aspect and try to find a way to identify and correct some of those areas if you had to create some compaction. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. All roads lead to World Dairy Expo at the Alliant Energy Center, September 30th through October 1st. So that's next week, folks. September 30th is a Tuesday. For 4 days every fall, Madison, Wisconsin becomes the dairy crossroads of the world, where dairy aficionados from around the world gather for World Dairy Expo. I don't think they could fit another world in that sentence. From September 30th through October 3rd, which is funny because it says through October 1st in the, which is funny. They goofed up in the headline of this article. That's 2 days, September 30th and October 1st.
October 1st, yeah.
till October 3rd, the 164-acre campus of the Alliant Energy Center becomes a hive of activity where farmers can connect and network with people from all over the country. Days before the first cow struts across the colored shavings, cattle breeders from across North America transport their elite show strings of show cattle from the far corners of North America, some traveling thousands of miles. Incidentally, this year's theme is All Roads Lead to Madison. These elite bovines are housed inside the 290,000 square foot New Holland Pavilions, which replaced 9 agricultural barns in 1995, as well as inside 2 dairy cattle tents. The cattle displays are kept spick and span and provide the pampered cows a comfortable experience while they're far from home. They'll also have the trade show, educational events such as Tanbark Talks, Knowledge Nook Sessions, and other seminars starting on Tuesday. The cows will begin stepping onto the colored shavings in the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, formerly known as the Dane County Coliseum, on Sunday, September 28th, for the International Junior Dairy Show. Each breed, Ayrshire, Guernsey, Jersey, Brown Swiss, Milking Shorthorn, Holstein, and Red and White, will compete inside the 58-year-old structure. World Dairy Expo typically features 2,500 head of cattle from more than 1,600 exhibitors showcasing genetics and services in its famous dairy cattle show, which includes breed shows. Last year, 2,527 head of cattle were exhibited. So, plenty to see, plenty to do. Head on down to Madison for this unique event that happens every fall. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So World Dairy Expo was not always in Madison, Wisconsin. It all began in Waterloo, Iowa. The town had a special aura for showmen and dairy people and annually hosted the National Dairy Cattle Congress Show. But when the show began experiencing financial difficulties in the mid-1960s, Wisconsinite Alan Hetz swooped in to save the day. A Fort Atkinson breeder, Hetz sensed a change in the show and feared the dairy shows would soon become a thing of the past. So in 1963, Hetz determinedly began gathering a group of visionaries to establish a new show. When the National Holstein Association Board of Directors unanimously voted to withhold the designation of the National Holstein Show in December 1965, Hetz, along with farmers, governmental and educational leaders, and agribusiness heads throughout Wisconsin, created a corporation called the World Food and Agriculture Foundation. Meanwhile, completion of the Dane County Veterans Memorial Coliseum provided Madison with one of the nation's hottest exposition sites in April 1967. Now a part of the Alliant Energy Center, the Memorial Coliseum held the first World Food Expo in September of 1967, making the event one of the venue's earliest clientele. In 1970, dairy interests from across the U.S. recognized the importance of and feasibility of a trade show, specifically for dairy farmers. The World Dairy Expo was born, a new corporation formed, and purchased the assets of the World Food and Agricultural Foundation's World Dairy Exposition, taking the name World Dairy Expo, Inc. After 49 years, the World Dairy Expo has grown to include more than 835 companies from 25 countries, 44 U.S. states, and 6 Canadian provinces. Total attendance in 2014 reached a record of 77,204 visitors. Just as its days in Waterloo, the Dairy Cattle Show continues to attract show cattle fans from around the globe. Every year, 2,500 head of cattle are exhibited. As World Dairy Expo looks forward to its 50th anniversary, or looked toward its 50th anniversary in 2016, it reflected a legacy of innovation and excellence as it anticipates continued growth, development, and success. So, if 2016 was 50, we're almost 10 years beyond that, so we're almost to 60. That'd be next year, I guess, would be the 60th anniversary. It's pretty cool.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. This is a good podcast to listen on your way down to Expo. And when you're down there, just tell a farmer friend about Tilt Talk Radio. That's all we ask. It's really easy. Just search Tilt Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. And you can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilt Talk Radio.
All right. Now it's time to get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans?
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Farmers want transparency when it comes to the new fertilizer bill. So rising fertilizer prices continue to weigh heavily on farmers' bottom lines. Recently, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, along with Iowa Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, introduced bipartisan legislation called the Fertilizer Research Act. The bill is designed to increase transparency in the fertilizer market and help farmers better understand the factors behind rising costs. The bill has the support of several farm organizations, including the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association, WCGA members, and farmer Shane Gulpin of HV Acres LLC, says greater insight into pricing is badly needed. Without having transparency in the fertilizer market, we really don't know trends. He explained, from a farmer's perspective, it seems like if grain prices go up, fertilizer prices go up. Why? We don't know. Fertilizer makes up nearly 40% of farmers' costs. Unpredictability in the market makes it difficult for farmers to plan ahead or lock in profits. Gulpin said, this uncertainty threatens not only current operations, but the next generation of farmers. We continue to struggle at the farm gate level of cost production and stress of trying to turn a profit. What are we doing to attract the next generation, he asked. Supporters of the bill hope that by improving transparency, farmers will gain a clearer view of market trends, and that will ultimately help secure a more stable future for U.S. agriculture. Are that's corny this week. Still no soybean sales from China. They have actually increased their purchase of soybeans from Argentina. So not just Brazil, but also Argentina in South America. So China significantly ramped up its buying of soybeans from Argentina this week after the South American country suspended export taxes. Importers in China have expanded purchases to at least 35 cargoes, up from an earlier tally of only 20 shipments, according to people familiar with the matter who asked not to be identified as they are not authorized to speak to the media. Most of the soybeans are slated.
Why are they speaking?
That's a pretty standard line. A lot of times sources ask not to be identified to maintain their anonymity. Most of the soybeans are slated to be loaded in November. According to Bloomberg, initial reports earlier this week said China had purchased 10 cargoes of Argentine beans. China is the world's largest importer and typically turns to U.S. supplies between October and February. The latest Argentine cargoes number is equivalent to more than 2.27 million tons of soybeans. The most soybeans China has imported from the South American country on a monthly basis was 2.23 million tons in July of 2015. So they're buying soybeans, just not from us. Hopefully that changes, but we'll see. Now to wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. The deadline is near to nominate the 2026 Master Agriculturist. So the award deadline is October 8th. In 2026, the Wisconsin Agriculturist will again honor Wisconsin farmers who have demonstrated outstanding farm management skills while also taking an active leadership role in their community. The Master Agriculturist Award are made to honor not only the selected individuals, but also their families. The Master Agriculturist Program has a rich history dating back 96 years to 1930, when the magazine first started honoring top Wisconsin farmers. This past year, 2025's Master Agriculturists are Ron Brooks of Wapaka, Jeffrey Kenneker of Cuba City, Bob Mitchell of Wazika, and Don Weiss of Durand. To have a nomination form mailed or emailed to you, you can call the Wisconsin Agriculturist Editorial Office at 920-960-9635 or email fran.o'leary at farmprogress.com. Nominations must be postmarked by October 8th. Letters of recommendation help strengthen the nomination and should be included. Agronomists, extension ag agents, ag lenders, nutritionists, veterinarians, neighbors, and clergy members are good sources to write a letter of recommendation. Winners will be selected by a committee of industry leaders and honored March 25th at LeSure's Banquet Hall in Oshkosh during the WPS Farm Show, March 24th to the 26th. Winners will also be featured in the March issue of the Wisconsin Agriculturist. Past winners will be invited to attend the 2026 Master Agriculturist Awards program and luncheon. So there you go. If you know someone you think is deserving of that honor, feel free to nominate them. You've got a little bit of time yet to get those nominations in. But that'll do it for us this week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks
for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us,
man. I know I messed it up. Screwed it up! Fix it in post. No, we won't. We don't fix
it. It's the end anyway.
It's the end. But thank you, the listener, for listening. And as always, happy farming.